Are you living in the past? Are you still drinking mediocre coffee that you got at the grocery store or your local cafe? Because it's time to evolve to the next level of coffee enjoyment. It's time to switch to Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. The coffee of the future is kicking it old school with high standards and attention to detail. But you still get to enjoy autopilot set and forget it deliveries so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. And right now, Sparkplug is offering Top 100 listeners a special deal. If you enter the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. The promo doesn't apply to gear, but it does apply to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. Don't you think it's time for stale, mediocre coffee to go extinct? Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
How goes, movie dinosaurs? And thank you for tuning in the next 109 Project, the mostly every Monday podcast that showcases a slew of classic films. If you think spoilers should be extinct, you're in the wrong era and listening to the wrong podcast. I'm the guy who's asking you to hold on to your butts, Ryan Ellis, and here's the lady who spared no expense, my Meatosaurus wife, Bev.
That's me.
No veggies in this household. Well, there's lots of veggies, but we like our meat. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Jurassic Park. Samuel L. Jackson has died in a lot of his movies, usually in a hail of gunfire. But name at least three instances where Sam has died at the hands, or claws, or jaws, or something, of an animal.
I could only find one other one other than Jurassic Park. It's Deep Blue Sea, like the easiest guess.
We're not gonna fight anymore. We're gonna pull together.
One of the greatest death scenes in cinematic history, and one of the best B films in cinematic history. And I even found death reels on YouTube. People have made compilations of all the ways Samuel L. Jackson has died in movies. And I just can't find the third way. Was it like an animated movie or something?
Nope. It was just last year. But before I say what it is, Jurassic Park, he has made the point in interviews, or maybe he did 25 years ago, that he wasn't necessarily dead. All they found was an arm. He could be wandering around on that island, probably starving to death, or eaten very quickly by another dinosaur. But we don't know he's dead.
He could have been the deus ex machina at the end of the film. The T-Rex beat him to it, but he was just right outside the door with a gun ready to save everybody.
Motherfucker!
With one arm.
And I looked it up. I've never seen Snakes in a Plane because I'm never going to watch Snakes in a Plane because they are my biggest phobia. But he didn't die. He survived that movie. No! Kong, Skull Island last year. The giant monkey destroyed him. And maybe he actually died of lung cancer in Jurassic Park. That could be the other possibility.
Oh, because he chain smokes in the entire movie?
I think he's always either holding a cigarette or is surrounded by cigarette smoke.
He's stressed out, man!
All right, Cretaceous Park, which is what it should have been called, because most of these animals were in the Cretaceous era. I've read that before. But it was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists, and obviously it didn't make those lists. It was released by Universal Pictures 25 years ago today, on June 11th, 1993, and I guess we all know it was a monster. Big hit at the box office. I don't know why we're doing a skinny for this one, but go ahead, Bev, read it for the fans who've forgotten what Jurassic Park is about.
Welcome to Jurassic Park, a remote theme park on a tropical island where scientists have found a way to resurrect long-extinct dinosaurs. It's a marvel of the modern world, undergoing its final inspection by a team of experts when sabotage strikes, and the park guests find themselves fighting for their lives, trapped on the island with some of history's greatest predators.
Or, in a nutshell, Newman! Probably the shortest nutshell I've ever done. It's all Wayne Knight's fault that this goes wrong. Although something would have gone wrong.
He's such an idiotic, cartoonish villain.
I'm bringing back something I haven't done in a little while. Reasonably good questions. Here's the first one. Involving Wayne Knight in his first scene. And his whole motivation in the whole film. What are the odds there would be a rival dinosaur theme park at the same time as Jurassic Park?
Well, they don't have a theme park. They want a theme park, which is why they need those
What's what I mean? What are the odds that they're trying to do the same thing? that they have the same kind of funding, that they have the same sort of possibilities, the technology and all that. Is it just, we can do it if John Hammond can do it? Maybe that's what it is. Okay, anyway, let's get through some numbers. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 92% of them liked it, 111 fresh, 10 rotten, 91% of audiences. And it's 191st on the IMDb 250, and I think it even went up a spot or two since I looked about a week or so ago. It was also naturally first at the 1993 U.S. box office. Schindler's List, which we covered for the Top 100 Project, was 9th. Groundhog Day, which we covered a few years ago, was 13th. And The Piano, which we covered only a few months ago, was 38th. This film was briefly the biggest hit ever in real money, not adjusted for inflation, because, of course, that's gone with the wind. It passed E.T., which was 11 years old at that point, and then Titanic passed it 4 years later. And it's still 17th, though, on Box Office Mojo's top 300 adjusted for inflation. Jurassic World is 24th, and Jurassic Park 2, well, The Lost World, Jurassic Park, is 108th. So people love their dinosaur films, but the first one is still the king of all of them. Well, enough of that. What did you think of Jurassic Park?
Slightly unpopular opinion here. It's fine. I kind of feel the same way about Jurassic Park as I do about Raiders. Heavy on the fun, light on the complexity. I see its appeal. Movies like this are so not for me. However, highest possible praise for the action sequences. Each one is a masterpiece, but especially the one with the T-Rex and the Jeeps, out of this world.
I think that takes place an hour into this movie, which is just over 2 hours long.
Yeah, we don't see a dinosaur until we're an hour in.
No, no.
Oh,
we
no,
see dinosaurs
true. We
at
see
the 20-minute mark.
That's true.
That's when we first see the ones that overwhelm everybody, the Brachiosaur and then the herd. They're moving in herds. They do move in herds. But we don't see the T-Rex until about an hour in, kind of like the shark in Jaws. This movie has a Jaws-like opening where an innocent is killed and we can't see the killer beast.
Even the way his body is being manipulated by the dinosaur
is similar
to Jaws.
Although the raptor probably wouldn't do what it does. The guy is halfway up the cage.
But it looks cool.
Yeah. Well, also the black guy is killed first, which is a horror film staple. And Jaws and Jurassic Park are horror films in ways, at least. Why don't the tasers that they use on this thing, and a lot of these guys are tasing the raptor, have any effect on it? Maybe it doesn't hurt it or kill it that much, but you think it'll at least drop the guy or stop or something. But it's still a great moment where Muldoon is trying his best to hold the guy, and then you see the hand get pulled through in slow motion as it just ekes away. He does his best, and he can't actually save the guy's life. After that, we meet Sam Neill and Laura Dern, Grant and Sattler, on their dig in Montana. I think it's Montana, right? And then, of course, John Hammond, who comes in his helicopter. Well, he's already in their trailer, yet there's a helicopter. Anyway, he straight up buys them by funding their dig. And then at the end, they betray him. They betray their boss. Although they should betray their boss because he's created a death park.
I thought he came around at the end to admit
he
that
did.
His creation. Okay, so they didn't betray him.
Not in Michael Crichton's book, I don't think he did. But
in the book, he's quite a bit more of a villain. In the book, he's a little bit more like the mayor in Jaws,
okay,
who cares more about making money than about the safety of the people.
Isla, or I guess it's Isla Nublar is where this is. It's off the coast of Costa Rica. We've been there, in fact, only a few months ago, and we do recommend Costa Rica, by the way. We also know how disappointing zoos and animal attractions can be in Costa Rica. Fuck you, sloth!
Wake up!
You're supposed to be fed. You're just laying there doing nothing, like a sloth. And of course, then we see Grant making the female-to-female seatbelt situation work. Safety, finds a way.
You never pick that up the first few times you see the movie, but it is a great metaphor for what comes later.
I've only seen recently, the internet's been pointing this out, about how that is foreshadowing the female-to-female thing with the dinosaurs themselves. But the seatbelts themselves, specifically, are the female ends. I never thought about that. Him jury-rigging a solution is one thing, but had it been the two male ends, the insertion ends, would have been a little less effective. Before we meet Lex and Tim, there's a throwaway line about the parents of these kids getting divorced, which is a Steven Spielberg staple. Now, those kids, I think they're fine. They're not as good as some of the actors that Spielberg has had in some of his films in the past, especially
child actors.
Yeah, he's been great with child actors, the E.T. actors, all three of them. And then I've always said Haley Joel Osment in AI
is
fantastic. One of the best performances that anyone's ever given, really. That was a great performance in AI. So what do you think of their performances? And I guess for that matter, all the performances. In a movie that's not about acting performances. And also a movie that doesn't have any really big stars. Jeff Goldblum was a name. Sam Neill was sort of a name. Laura Dern was, I guess, too. Richard Attenborough had been acting forever and directing for a while at that point. But none of these people are stars, the way you think of the word star. Harrison Ford could have played Grant. But when he turned it down, they went with this lesser-known actor, and maybe because it made more sense, why have big stars?
Didn't they bring Sam Neill in, like, just weeks before? They were trying to get other bigger actors to do the part.
Oh, I didn't read that.
Never happened. And then, kind of at the last minute, he only had weeks to prepare.
Movies like this always have a lot of people you could name that could have had the part. I just mentioned Harrison Ford. William Hurt just flat-out turned it down. I don't think he even read the script. Kevin Costner, Mel Gibson, Robin Williams, strange choice. Maybe he could have played Malcolm a little better than he could have played Grant. Dennis Quaid and Tom Sizemore. That's a strange one. So most of those guys are movie stars, but then they go with Sam Neill, who the same year had done The Piano. But that wasn't out yet, I don't think. No, that came in the fall, I believe.
It's different audiences,
Different
too.
Audiences, yeah. And it wasn't a big name
movie. A lot of overlap.
Movie.
I think the dinosaurs are the star.
They are. Like, The shark is the star in Jaws. Another movie without any big stars. Roy Scheider was known. Robert Shaw was known. Dreyfuss was getting there. But now those people are what you think of movie stars. Lee Marvin, had he been in that movie, or Charlton Heston, they are big stars, but they weren't in it. It was Robert Shaw instead.
And it's funny going back and watching Jurassic Park now because so many of those people, even if they aren't stars, at least have done far more iconic things, like Newman. What's his name?
Wayne Knight,
yeah. Of course, we just always know him as Newman. Sam Jackson has had an incredible career. Laura Dern has had an incredible career. Jeff Goldblum is Jeff Goldblum. He's an institution in and of himself. So we come back to the movie now, 25 years later, with all these associations with these actors. But at the time, it was really just that lack of distraction. E.T. did that too, no big names in E.T., and it's a good way to get audiences to invest in the characters and not bring any other assumptions with them. I don't know if it's even worth it because it's not like the characters have a ton of depth in Jurassic Park.
Is that one of the reasons you think maybe you didn't like this movie all that much?
I think it's just a silly action movie is not something I typically enjoy. The same way I don't like Raiders. I don't throw shade on Raiders. I know there's something about it that makes people so happy, but I always leave the theater feeling cold, feeling like I missed something.
Action fatigue.
It could be fatigue, but I generally avoid it at this point. So I can't say I have fatigue. I think it's just not for me.
Okay. The movie has a lot of good lines of dialogue, even if the script is not necessarily the greatest. Things like, we're out of a job. Don't you mean extinct? And that was actually said by the effects guys when they saw the visual effects that ILM was doing. Because it was going to be go motion or stop motion or one of those two with the dinosaurs, and they didn't end up going that route. But just the whole scheme in this film, which is from Michael Crichton's book, a harebrained scheme, in fact, to extract dinosaur DNA from a mosquito. The blood would be so impure, there's no way this would ever work. Now, they do say they used frog DNA to fill in the gaps, and that's why you get the dinosaurs flipping over to be able to breed, because frogs could do that. I never really dwelled on it before, but it does seem pretty absurd. It is a sci-fi movie, though, in a way, and you have to go with sci-fi concepts.
Again, let's bring up E.T. or Jaws. Two movies that have absolutely ridiculous things happen that don't make any sense. But you don't care. You just enjoy it. You're along for the ride. Jurassic Park doesn't seem to take itself that seriously. Like, it embraces its own silliness to some extent. But like a million movies, who cares if the science holds up? You're just there for the ride.
Well, that's what this podcast is for. To poke holes in it.
And it's funny we say that because the science that it took to create Jurassic Park and the advances in visual effects, so amazing, but maybe the most miraculous thing about what they accomplished isn't the advances in visual effects that showed us things that we had never seen before, and it really was dazzling, you know, in 1993, going to the movies, it blew us away. But probably more amazing than that is that now, watching it 25 years later, I'm still like, dinosaurs. I still think it looks great. It's not distracting. It doesn't look dated. It doesn't look campy. There's maybe a couple of shots. Oh, that one is not their best work. But most of them, especially the really high-stakes sequences like the T-Rex chasing the car, you are so invested. It just looks like a dinosaur 25 years later.
You know one reason why? Is there's actually very little CGI in this movie, considering it's a CGI movie that people assume is filled with it. This movie took off of what came from T2, and that took off of what came from The Abyss. Both of those are Jim Cameron movies, of course. But the visual effects kept on taking leaps and bounds. Forrest Gump the next year would take it even further, and look where we are now. But an awful lot of the dinosaur shots are either models or they're people in suits. The raptors are basically human size, and plenty of times there's people just operating them the old-fashioned way with sticks and whatnot. Or you see a close-up of the foot of the raptor tapping its foot on the kitchen table. That's just somebody with that part of a foot. Off-screen, they're holding the thing and they're making it tap. When the giant T-Rex leg comes into view, when Grant and Lex are outside the Jeep and it blows his hat off, the thing that goes into the mud was an actual foot.
How did they do the iris? Was that an animatronic?
That must have been a visual effect. I think that was probably CGI.
Oh, God.
And because it's obscured by darkness and water with all the rain, Spielberg has to make it harder for the CGI guys. Yeah, it'll be in the dark, so it'll be a little bit obscured that way with the darkness, but I'll put rain into it. And actually, the rain messed with that T-Rex model. It was so specifically made that if it got wet, it would do all herky-jerky stuff. So sometimes they'd have to towel it off and use hair dryers and whatnot. Because the head also, a lot of the time, was real. When it blows a snort of air into Grant and his hat gets blown off, unlike Indiana Jones, he no longer has his hat the rest of the film. That hat is gone. But when that happens, that is also a model.
Isn't that the exact thing that happened to the Jaws shark? They built this great animatronic shark, but then it got wet and it got too heavy. The stuff that they use to make the outer shell is kind of like spongy and absorbs all the water.
And then the salt water messed with all the stuff inside that made it operate properly.
Why didn't he learn his lesson? Of anybody. He should have known better than to incorporate an animatronic figure like that and a bunch of water.
Except you needed rain because that's the storyline. There's a hurricane, that's why everyone's leaving the park for the weekend, and we're only left with our main characters. And that's also why Dennis Nedry dies, because he's in a rainstorm. He can't get to the boat in time, and then he gets nailed by the Dilophosaurus. He wouldn't have had to get out of the truck if it weren't for the fact that he had to get out of the truck.
No character in cinema has ever deserved to die more than Nedry does. The idiotic things he does, the complete lack of planning. He does run into some rather cartoonish mishaps, and I'm specifically thinking of this sign, exit this way, that for some reason flips around. The arrow spins as if the dock changes places and they need it to be flexible.
They built a lot of them and they had to put them in different places, so it had to go different ways. In this case, they spared an expense. Yes. Hammond spared some expenses. Then again, really good actress, Laura Dern. But there's a few moments with her character that I have to question. How oblivious is Ellie not to notice noisy dinosaurs? Because when they first come upon the Brachiosaur, it would have been making some kind of noise. We don't really hear it, but we have to go by reality. Why didn't none of them notice any of the dinosaurs until we notice the dinosaurs kind of thing? You know what I'm saying? Until the movie notices.
Her chief job in the movie seems to be to just look upon things with awe and be bemused by the men in the movie.
They give her more to do than the book did. She goes to turn the power on. That wasn't her job in the book.
And she is smart and capable, mm-hmm. and they treat her like she's smart and capable. She's definitely not just like a useless damsel. So you're right. I take that back. She has more to do.
But also, how does any scientist, Sattler, whoever, know nothing of chaos theory? Was it just a new thing? That's real, I believe. I don't think this movie made it up or the book made it up.
I think it's just a way different discipline. Why, when you're trying to determine the safety of what is essentially kind of like a wildlife reserve, do you hire a chaos theorist? What good is he?
Because he's right. I hate being right all the time.
They make a great big stink about the two female ends of the seatbelt, and dinosaurs are female, and he's like, life finds a way, and then he's right, and then you see the eggs, and the dinosaurs are breeding. So what? It has no effect on the film whatsoever.
I think it's part of the backstory where there's supposed to be control from the scientists. The arrogance of B.D. Wong, who's in Jurassic World, and I think he's going to be in Jurassic World 2. Much bigger part. He's barely in this movie, but his whole thing about you're suggesting that animals that are entirely female will breed. And of course, that's what's been happening, obviously, before he even says that line. So maybe the movie is saying that it doesn't have any effect on our story over the course of a few days is all it is. But the failsafe will fail. They lysine contingency, they won't be fed that stuff, so then they'll die. That's the idea. If they just bailed on the island and didn't live there anymore, didn't work there anymore, the dinosaurs wouldn't live too long. But if they're creating their own creatures, then those ones can live on. And it's also ironic to suggest that they could live on past and not go extinct, and yet that's what happened to them in reality. No actual dinosaurs, I mean, alligators and sharks resemble them in some ways. Although, Grant in this movie goes on about how they're like birds. Another reasonably good question, when they're in Montana, when we first meet him, no one on his team seems to recognize this whole thing about them being birds. The kid questions him, which makes sense, but it's not like everyone's saying, oh, we've heard him talk about this for years. They should know him well enough to know that he thinks the dinosaurs are the ancestors of birds.
Michael Crichton didn't pull that out of thin air. Paleontologists at the time were theorizing that.
They really say it now.
They're almost sure now.
They're confirming that dinosaurs, well, I don't know if they can confirm it, but they really believe dinosaurs had feathers. And a lot of people say, dinosaurs wouldn't have had feathers. Well, those things wouldn't be in the ground. The bones are. But the feathers have been long gone. It's like your hair, if you're a corpse in the ground, isn't there forever.
We've been looking at artist renderings of dinosaurs for all this time. It's easy to forget. Nobody knows what a dinosaur looked like. They don't know what color they were. They don't know if they have, well, they suspect they have feathers. There's all these details about them that they're never going to know, but they kind of presume things, and then we just take it as fact.
There's also speculation that the T-Rex didn't run on its hind legs all the time. It's like a bear, they think, maybe now. where it would have had to be using those puny little front legs to run around, to exist. It would be on its back legs for a little bit of time, but it had so much weight that it couldn't maintain that and just stay like that all the time.
And the film doesn't really care that much about being accurate. There's all kind of liberties, things that they absolutely knew that they took liberties with, like the Velociraptors were much, much smaller. They were like the size of chickens. Mm-hmm. T-Rex, like you said, couldn't run, but also the detail that their vision is motion-based. First of all, how on earth would you know that? How would you know what their vision is based on? But scientists are actually saying now, no, actually the placement of their eye sockets suggests that they have binocular vision, much like birds of prey. The Dilophosaurus, which is the one that takes out Nedry, mm-hmm. they're not that big. They had no neck frill, and they didn't spit venom. Every detail that's important about that dinosaur in the movie is not accurate. There was a couple things with the Brachiosaurus as well. They couldn't stand on their hind legs. They didn't chew their food. That was considered pretty unlikely. Oh, and also they were considered very unlikely to have made any sound. They didn't have anything in their bone structure to suggest the vocal cords of any kind.
Brachiosaurus or any of them?
Brachiosaurus.
Oh, okay. The T-Rex thing, well, you got to give it one weakness. If it can see you, too, and with the speed they say it can run, well, it keeps up with the Jeep until it gets into third or fourth gear, so if they can run that fast, and they can see you, and they have the giant teeth, then how do you ever possibly defeat the thing?
Well, what's the Raptor's weakness? Getting eaten by Tyrannosaurus Rexes?
Well, the Raptor's one of the favorites of everybody. I guess the T-Rex is really the favorite. It was the hero of this movie in the end. John Williams decided it was the hero of the music score, is what I was reading somewhere. And it's certainly the hero in Jurassic World. In fact, it's let out by Bryce Dallas Howard from its pen to save the day, specifically. Of course, there's one that's been asked for a long time. Reasonably good question for me, though. Why does the T-Rex make impact tremors at times, but is stealth at other times? Twice, not just at the end. Everyone's always talked about that, when it saves them in the visitor center. And how did it get inside the visitor center as well? But even when it goes after the Gallimimus, Grant and the kids are running away from the Gallimimus, which aren't attacking them. That was one of the more impressive effects, by the way, because they're surrounded by those dinosaurs. They're not just in a shot that's composited, which is also obviously very impressive. But when you're in there, it's even cooler. But when they crouch down under that log and the Gallimimus are gone, then the T-Rex is down there. Why don't you hear it getting closer? Why didn't they? Well, they may have been trying to get away from it, but why didn't we as the audience and then Grant and the kids hear it coming near them?
It's like the zombies in The Walking Dead. They only make noise when it's convenient, and when they want to give us a jump scare, they're suddenly super quiet.
A lot of what we're doing right now is expositing, and the movie is exposition theater early on, which I guess it has to be. You have to explain how dinosaurs are alive again. Some of it's done pretty well, some of it not so well. We do learn that the lead raptor killed all the other raptors. I guess there was quite a few of them in that pen, except for the two that it does let live, which is pretty sick to think that these things are actually killing each other when they're being fed as well. That's a pretty great scene. You still don't see those dinosaurs, well, the raptors. At the very beginning of the movie, the first scene is a raptor. We don't see it, except the eye. Then they destroy a cow, don't see them at all, and then we finally do with, I think, something like 20 minutes left. But more talking would be when they're all in the Jeeps and Malcolm has the whole God creates dinosaurs, man destroys God, all that stuff he says. And then Ellie's ending with woman inherits the earth.
It's one of the few great lines in the script that isn't given to Jeff Goldblum, because he just seems to have all the best lines, except for maybe that and hold on to your buns, which is another great one.
I found my note finally. Only 15 minutes of dinosaur footage in the whole film, and more than half of the 15 minutes are Stan Winston, we didn't even say his name yet, his animatronics.
Even the animatronics are absolutely out of this world. Mm-hmm. The best that there's ever been for dinosaurs.
So many movies that have ever had T-Rexes after have always looked like this one and sounded like this one.
The sound design, legendary. One of the greatest classics of creating sound out of thin air.
Because you have no idea what they sounded like. We can guess what they looked like, obviously, with the bones, but we don't know what they sounded like.
And Spielberg's instruction was, he wanted them to sound scary, obviously, but he really wanted them to sound grounded. He didn't want them to sound like monsters. He wanted them to sound like animals. And so the sound designers created these roars from manipulating all these other animals like dolphins and baby elephants.
Rattlesnake for the Dilophosaurus's fringe thing it does.
And a dog shaking his toys is one of the sounds as well.
When the T-Rex is killing the Gallimimus.
A whale's blowhole is how they got the sound for the exhale of the Brachiosaurus. All these great details, and then of course the sounds are manipulated and affected in all kinds of ways, and then they come out making these original sounds. And they add so much of the verisimilitude to the movie.
If you happen to hear a bass line, it's Saturday night. We were recording later than we intended to today, and maybe you're going to hear people partying. It's a wonderful sunny day in early June. And as the sun goes down, people are partying, I think. The sound is great, but that's part of technology. And the movie is all about technology fucking us over. I become less of a fan of technology as the years go on. Not because dinosaurs are going to kill us, but just in general, I'm not really as much of a fan as I used to be. I can keep up with it for the most part. I may be 44, but I'm not a Luddite, but I don't really like all that much.
You're a bit of a Luddite. Every year goes by, you definitely hate technology a little bit.
I lean on it all the time, like everyone. I'm not going to deny that. I'm on my phone an awful lot. I got to charge that thing every single day. I won't deny that. But I'm not a huge fan.
You could say the true villain of this movie is hubris.
Oh, of course.
Hubris with technology. Believing that with technology you can play God. You can make a flea circus out of dinosaurs, but you can't.
Well, one of the AFI nominations is the top 100 quotes. It didn't make the list, but life will find a way, which isn't even accurate. That's what it says on the AFI's website, but it's life finds a way. But also in that same scene, Malcolm talks about you didn't stop to think if you should. That should have been nominated too.
Yeah, I agree. I like that. I think there's a million great lines in this movie. Malcolm gets to say most of them. Can I just address it, this great line that everybody likes? Life finds a way. Does that apply to creatures who all did not find a way to live 65 million years ago? We're talking about all these creatures that went extinct. Life does not always find a way.
You gotta point more to do that, Bev. Gesture more.
Well, like, nobody can see. Nobody can see my Jeff Goldblum gestures.
This has been brought up by people for many years, and I think I read somewhere how they addressed what it was about. Maybe the Jeeps get turned around and they've gone further back. They're still in the T-Rex area, but not exactly where they were when you first see the... Well, then again, no, because the goat being fed is still right beside them. But the T-Rex attack happens right beside an enormous cliff, and yet it's not there when they first are driving by.
No, the cliff appears after the attack.
Because the T-Rex is beside the... Well, comes between the two Jeeps, and yet when it's attacking them and Grant and Lex have to climb down, that's a pretty cool action scene, too. There's no way that the T-Rex, as big as it is, would be anywhere near able to reach over and pop its head and say, "Hey, guys, I'm here to kill you."
How many times did you have to see this movie before little details like that, little inconsistencies, started to get noticed, started to bug you?
A few, at least. I've seen this movie lots of times, though.
Well, that's just it. I think it's so well done, and you're so caught up in the action, you just really don't think about it. It doesn't take very many viewings to get annoyed with the full hour of exposition at the top of the film. I know it's not a full hour of exposition, but it's really exposition heavy. It's really front-loaded with information that once you know it, that part of the movie isn't that interesting. Or it just isn't interesting enough. It's not nearly as enjoyable as the second half of the movie. If I was, like most kids my age, obsessed with Jurassic Park, then I probably would have watched it many times, and I think I would have just fast-forwarded the first half hour very often to get to the good stuff. Who cares? That weird scene where they're in the mine, they pull the amber out, and although the cartoon is pretty cute, but I can imagine that stuff gets pretty boring when you watch it over and over.
But even that has a nice touch, because Hammond isn't reading his lines, and he's even saying it's not finished. When it's done, there'll be all this music. Now, of course, they're at the theme park and it's not opening yet. That's the whole point, because it can't open until the investors are okay with all these people that he's brought in to say it's okay. But the point is, that film is not even finished, so it's spared no expense, and yet at the same point, this place is not ready. Even if Nedry wasn't betraying them, it still wasn't ready in little ways like that, and of course in the big ways.
Even starting with the exposition in the film, it's treated like a ride, and everything is very heavily automated. Of course, a decision that they make, which bites them in the ass, because when that automation fails, there's really no backup, and there's no way to protect yourself against the dinosaurs or get away from them.
Well, it's kind of a ride. But then the three of them managed to stop that, so right away they're destroying the technology in that place so easily. I don't know how even three grown people, two of the men, could manage to break that thing open and get in to see where the egg is, but anyway. We talked about pretty good lines in the movie, and after the T-Rex attacks and things are a little bit calm, when Ellie and Muldoon come in, "I think this was Gennaro. I think this was too." That's a nice touch. It's kind of like in Die Hard with a Vengeance, when you see a guy, you can't tell at the time, but he gets cut in half with a cable towards the end of the film, and Sam Jackson and Bruce Willis, one of them takes a half of the guy. Looks like they're going to just drag him away. They realize they're walking beside each other. One's got his legs, one has his arms. It's a pretty grisly effect. You don't really see anything, but you get the idea that it's been cut in half. So is this. Although, if the T-Rex was so hungry, why would it leave any of Gennaro behind?
Good point. Why did he eat Gennaro?
Which is true about the shark in Jaws as well. Why doesn't he eat all of Chrissy?
Yeah.
And, of course, the great line, "Must go faster. Must go faster." Which was also used in Independence Day. And I think I read somewhere that they just used the dialogue itself, that they used the track of Jeff Goldblum saying that line from this movie.
Oh, it must be a little homage then.
It's an homage, but it's not even a matter of him saying it again. It's a matter of them using it from this film. Maybe that's not true, because they're not the same studios. That was Fox, and this is Universal. Let's get back to the lead character, Grant. It's a nice touch. He uses the raptor claw to scare the kid in the opening sequence, or his opening sequence, that is. And then he throws it away when he's with kids, because, of course, he's been convinced to like kids. A few days ago, subscribers are going to know this already, we posted the Mighty Ducks. My friend Chris and I are doing a podcast offshoot that'll be in this feed, so if you didn't know that already, or if you deleted it or whatever, that's what's going on there. And in that film, the lead character doesn't like kids either, but he comes around very easily and very quickly. It takes one skate for Emilio Estevez to like kids. In this movie, it's one traumatic night, and then suddenly Grant is a kid guy.
If every human child was anything like that horrible kid at the beginning of Jurassic Park who's giving him the gears about what he likes or doesn't like about dinosaurs, if every kid was like that, humans would go extinct because nobody would like kids. Nobody would have a child.
You mean the guy in the desert?
The kid in the desert.
Oh, okay.
Tim's kind of annoying, but he's at least sweet. The kid in the desert is just such a sassy little asshole.
Why are you there if you don't believe in dinosaurs? Like the dinosaur concept?
Cool. You're like, this is stupid.
It's a dinosaur dig, asshole.
Why are you there, period? It's a work site.
Mom brought me.
Tourist attraction. Do you find the kids annoying? Do you like their performances?
They're not as good as the kids in E.T. or A.I. or Close Encounters. Barry. But they're fine. Joseph Mazzello, who plays Tim, has got a pretty good resume. He was in the sequel, which Ariane Richards was too, very briefly in the very beginning of the film. And then he's in The Social Network, and he's going to be in Bohemian Rhapsody very soon. That comes out later this year, I believe. Ariane Richards, who plays Lex, so far Jurassic Park 2 is her last movie. She plays trauma pretty well because she's pretty traumatized. So when you ask me that question, are the actors good? They're at least fine. Let's put it that way.
They're a solid B+. I get how they're kind of annoying, but I don't feel like they commit the worst child actor crimes.
Lex is in a way more believable because she should be as freaked out as she is after the things that she's seen. Tim really rolls with the punches. He's the one that gets electrocuted, which, by the way, wouldn't have happened either because he's not grounded. It's like a bird sits on a wire, so when Ellie turns the power back on, and that's a nice action sequence because the camera shows you the perimeter fence, which is where Tim is, but as long as he's not grounded, he could just sit there like a bird could and never actually be electrocuted.
No, but as long as he's touching two of the cords, then he would be a conduit between the two cords, and the electricity would flow through him that way. Oh. So he doesn't need to be grounded. Grounded just means the electricity flows through you to the ground. This way it just would flow through him to the other wire.
I guess the other thing that would be true is he wouldn't get blasted off the way he does. He would just sit there and cook to death.
10,000 volts, it wouldn't take long.
The reverse of that heat that goes through his body is the freezer. Hammond leaves the freezer open when he gets the ice cream. Didn't want it to go to waste. And I was reading this recently, too. There's all kinds of things about Jurassic Park. Maybe because other people knew the anniversary was a few weeks away when they started posting videos, and we're doing it on the actual anniversary, 25 years. But anyway, that inadvertently saves Tim because he sees that the freezer door is open and it's a little wet because the power is about to come back on, but it hasn't yet. And so the raptor gets trapped in the freezer. Those raptors, by the way, may be smart, but kind of like the sharks in Deep Blue Sea, they can't know things that they haven't been taught or that they can't logically figure out. The sharks are trying to sink that station in Deep Blue Sea to get free. They wouldn't know how to do that unless they were trained how to do that. Then, okay, fine, I'll go with you maybe on that. But same with this, the raptors can open doors.
I know.
Now, maybe they've somehow been watching humans, but it doesn't seem like there's any door handles in their paddock.
No, they wouldn't have any idea what to do inside the visitor center. But yeah, that is pretty ridiculous that they can open doors.
But they are stopped by the Deus Ex T-Rexa.
To me, that would kind of ruin the movie for me a little bit. My take when I was 15 years old and I saw this movie for the first time was, yeah, it was fine, but the ending was so dumb. I remember being, like, kind of surprised years later to discover just how enduringly popular it was. I didn't expect Jurassic Park to really have legs and last, and why people still consider it a classic that they watch all the time, whereas, say, other popular movies of the time, like Who Framed Roger Rabbit or Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, other really, really popular movies in the same kind of demographic have become footnotes.
Effects-heavy movies, though, too, that need for the gimmick to work.
And they were super popular. There were huge hits, high concept films that people loved. And I remember they were super zeitgeisty. If you had asked me then which movie is still going to get watched 25 years later, I would never have guessed Jurassic Park.
This movie might be just as popular. A lot of people who are around my age or a little younger, even younger than you, I guess, I think they like this movie to Star Wars level or at least pretty close to it.
Where would you rank this amongst Steven Spielberg's best action films? So I'm talking about Jaws, Raiders.
If it was just his movies, period, I would put it maybe not in the top 10. But the action movies, okay, then you're talking top 5, I would have to say for sure. Raiders is the best action movie that Spielberg's ever made, maybe the best ever.
Better than Jaws? You think it's better than Jaws?
Jaws isn't really an action movie.
Okay, let's consider Jaws an action movie, because it is, but whatever.
If we're using the word action, then Raiders is actually better than Jaws, yeah.
But you like Jaws better than Raiders.
Jaws is a better movie, but Raiders is a better action movie.
You have depths. I do. You have layers.
Jaws,
Ryan,
is hard to define, just like this movie is hard to define. There's elements of horror and obviously thriller. There is action adventure. There's just plain
downright
drama.
Downright silliness as well.
But plain drama. And there's also, not so much in this, but Jaws has an awful lot of comedy. Any good action film should have some funny moments, but that's one of the reasons why it's hard to really pigeonhole what Jaws was and is. Jurassic Park fits a lot of those same molds. One more reasonably good question before we get into the cast. We're going to go way back now to the sequence when the T-Rex attacks. How do two small children fight off a T-Rex with just a broken pane of safety glass?
Yeah, they should have had absolutely no chance whatsoever. That safety glass should have just crushed them to death when he put his weight on it.
Because why would it stop pushing down on them? There's no way that they can stop it at all, but especially when it's blasting its snout through there.
You know, no amount of reality can ruin that scene for me. It is so effective. This is what Spielberg does best. With the flashlight and then car flipping and then the mud coming in. And whatever you want to say about those kids, their acting in that moment is thoroughly convincing. Mm. Yeah. Everything about that scene is absolutely heart-stopping. No matter how many times I've seen it, it's as effective as the first time.
And you said before, the sound is a huge reason why. That's true, too.
And no score in that scene. John Williams takes a breather.
This is a pretty good music score, though. It wasn't nominated for the Oscar. He's been nominated for Oscars so many times with the Spielberg movies, and he's got so many scores we all know so well. Well, this one with the dun 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 dun. Pretty famous bit of music.
It has a beautiful, awe-inspiring mood to it. It's really appropriate. I don't think it's his best composition as far as, like, it's just not the catchiest tune. It's not, like, my favorite music that I would just listen to in the car the way I might actually with, say, the soundtrack for Raiders. But it's really super appropriate for a movie that really indulges us in that awe-inspiring feeling. They really want us to feel the magic of discovery before they turn that discovery into a total disaster.
It turns around and eats the tourists, as yes. Goldblum says. So we talked about Sam Neill already. Laura Dern, of course, is known for a lot of the Lynch movies, and also Wild a few years ago she was in that. She was engaged to Jeff Goldblum for a few years because they met on this movie. But the role could have been Juliette Binoche's, and she went on to do the Three Colors movies instead. Or it was Three Color Blue, I think, specifically she did. Probably a good choice, I guess, to do the Three Colors movie instead. Although, this would have made her more money. Jeff Goldblum, all the credits that guy has. He was in the first sequel, and is a big part of that sequel. The kids are in it, but very briefly. And then only a few months ago, was in Thor Ragnarok doing his Jeff Goldblum thing. He's cool in all those memes you see online, with the chest out and all that kind of stuff.
It's like someone told him he was going to be in a different kind of movie. Like, all these people are making a monster film, but you're in a porno, so just undo that top button and try and be as smooth as you can.
You don't think of him as being ripped, and yet in The Fly, which was 7 years before this, well, he had to be because he gets great muscles in that film. That's the idea, is he's developing into The Fly. And here, 7 years later, he's still pretty ripped. You don't think of him in that Schwarzenegger way, which he isn't that anyway, but he is surprisingly muscular, isn't he?
He has a nice figure. He does indeed.
Jim Carrey may have had the role, though, and that would have been a whole different thing, because he does not have the muscles, or the Jeff Goldblumness.
He doesn't have the cool. He just doesn't have the cool. I think he would have made it funnier, maybe, although Jeff Goldblum is
funny,
pretty
though.
Funny. I wouldn't want to see anyone else in the part. But I could see Carrey pulling it off, definitely giving it a different flavor, but I think it still would have been good.
Richard Attenborough is John Hammond. He was in The Great Escape and Miracle on 34th Street, the remake, which was the year after Jurassic Park. He directed Gandhi in 82, which won the Oscars, the big ones at least, picture and director, and also best actor. But picture and director over E.T., which a lot of people were scandalized by then, is certainly more so now, because Gandhi's about a more important person, a real person, as opposed to some alien, but the better movie, certainly the more lasting movie, is E.T. But one of the nice subtexts is that Spielberg didn't hold a grudge, and why would he? It's not like Attenborough stuffed the ballot boxes. He won the Oscars, and he was very gracious that night. I just watched his speech, because I'd read somewhere that he had said he wished Spielberg had won at least Best Director. Now, maybe he did that backstage, but in his speeches for Best Director, and then he was the producer on Gandhi, he didn't say anything about that. He was very gracious, but didn't actually say, oh, Steven should have won this award. He's dressed all in white like a Jesus-esque savior, although, as we talked about on E.T., Spielberg's mother would be bothered by some Jesus comparisons. But he's really just a dark Walt Disney, which is what Michael Crichton wanted him to be in the first place. And, of course, this version of him is not nearly as sinister as he is in the book, or as oblivious. Big names are thought of. We talked about No Stars. Well, Clint Eastwood and Marlon Brando were bandied about. But the movie smartly doesn't go with them. That would have been the wrong thing to do.
He has, like, grandfatherly quality, which I think is what he's meant to have. Because he really means to do well. He has good intentions. He just suffers from hubris.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Knight, of course, was on Seinfeld, and before this was actually a pretty good run here. He was in JFK in 91, Basic Instinct in 92. Small roles, but still he's in them. And then this film in 93. And his name is an anagram of Nerdy Sind, Dennis Nedry.
Is that intentional?
Probably.
Huh.
Bob Peck is Muldoon. Martin Ferrero is the lawyer who gets killed. Muldoon wears short shorts.
Why wouldn't he? Look at those thighs.
And he died only 6 years after this movie came out. When he is saying the raptor paddock, I thought with his accent he was just trying to say park, until I threw the subtitles on one day and saw that it's no, P-A-D-D-O-C-K. And then Martin Ferrero was still alive, but he's done nothing since 2001. I always find that interesting when somebody's not made a movie and they aren't that old or they're not dead. I mean, that they aren't making films anymore. And of course, Samuel L. Jackson, who is the cigarette-smoking man. And you hear him before you see him because you hear his voice on the intercom before you actually see him in person. And also, he's one of those guys like Tom Cruise who's worked with a lot of the big-name directors, and you sometimes forget he worked with Scorsese on Goodfellas and Spielberg in this. We've covered so many Steven Spielberg movies. Six of them were on the AFI list. We did all of those, obviously. He did the post-production effects on this while filming Schindler's List, meaning he was over in Poland making that heart-wrenching, devastating movie, which was really hurting him emotionally, while doing a goofy one like this. But he did leave it in the hands of George Lucas. He was involved, but Lucas was really truly overseeing it.
So, while his good friend George Lucas was overseeing it, he said that watching what they were accomplishing with Jurassic Park convinced him that it was finally time to make this Star Wars prequels. So shame on you, Steven Spielberg. It is your fault that we were subjected to those terrible movies.
I think it's also Jurassic Park that inspired Stanley Kubrick to try to make AI, because he saw that the visual effects could work to have David in that movie be a robot. And the effects in AI are underrated. They're
very
good.
Especially for the time. I only saw it for the first time maybe a few years ago, and they don't look dated.
Spielberg brought Jurassic Park under schedule, which seems impossible for a movie like this. But he was going to make ER, which is a Crichton book also, meaning the TV series. That's why he's an executive producer on ER.
Isn't that how he met Crichton? And that's why Crichton told him his idea for this book that he was finishing.
And then Spielberg said, oh, dinosaurs, yeah. Hey, that's more interesting than doctors.
That's why he decided to bid on the movie. But there was a bidding war. There were all these different studios.
Jim Cameron almost had it, but Spielberg
beat
him to the punch.
Yeah, like each studio had its big name director. Tim Burton was another one. I think he was with Warner. Universal and Spielberg outbid everybody or whatever and got to make the film. And thank goodness, although it would have been very curious to see what Tim Burton's take on this would have been.
Yeah. Cameron admitted it would have been a lot more bloody and R-rated and vicious and all that kind of thing. Probably a lot of swearing as well. I said Spielberg was going to make ER, meaning into a movie, but of course it just became a long-running TV series. The writers were Crichton himself and David Koepp, a name you've probably seen in a lot of credits, including Mission Impossible, Spider-Man. A lot of times he's a rewriter as well, but he's been involved in some big blockbusters. And it was based on Crichton's 1990 novel. He wrote and directed Westworld, meaning the movie, in 1973, by the way.
Another movie about a park full of technology that goes wrong and starts killing the guests.
That's right. The producers were Kathleen Kennedy, Miss Powerhouse now. She's in charge of Lucasfilm. And Gerald Molan, the Triceratops doctor we see briefly in this film, who was also a producer on Schindler's List. And he was in Rain Man, which we covered a few months ago. He's Dr. Bruner. Jurassic Park, Cretaceous Park, is 1:85:1, but it was actually shot in the 1:33, so the square ratio. That's what Spielberg did. I think he did that in a couple other movies he made.
Because he knew it was going to air on television.
I think that might have been what it was. He and Scorsese have talked about how they didn't want to make true widescreen movies, the 2:35:1 movies, too much back in this era, because it'd be cut down for television. They'd have to pan and scan it, so literally cut off the sides.
They really do consider their audience fully and don't expect their audience to do all the work to come to them and see the movie properly.
Meaning Spielberg and Scorsese.
Yeah. Well, Spielberg especially, yeah, he wants to come to you. He wants to meet you at your level always. That's actually a really appealing thing about him.
The best crowd-pleasing director who's ever lived.
Absolutely.
It's really not even in dispute at this point, if it ever was. And we watched the Blu-ray, of course, which looks great. I would say it's aged quite well, and they've done a good job on the print. The cinematographer, Dean Cundey, who shot a lot of the Carpenter flicks, including The Thing, which we covered last October. And he also did Back to the Future and Apollo 13. So he has shot some of my favorite movies, including Back to the Future especially. The editor, Michael Kahn, who's cut almost every single Spielberg film, and he still is working in his 80s. He's won 3 Oscars for Raiders, for Schindler's List, and for Saving Private Ryan. And of course, we talked about John Williams, who did all the Spielberg AFI films. Star Wars, he's won 5 Oscars. Okay, the influence. We've gone over some of it already. It's influenced by the original King Kong, including a line by Jeff Goldblum, where he says, well, they got in there, King Kong.
And the gates.
And even the Island of Dr. Moreau. That's an influence on this as well. There have been three sequels and counting, plus all the merchandise. That's one of the best things from Lucas and Spielberg-type films is merchandising, as much as the movies themselves that have been blockbusters. The toys. There's literal toys in this movie you see, because why wouldn't there be? It is the gift shop. But it's also stuff you could have bought, if not already, in real life in 1993, soon after you saw that, when you saw the movie in June.
And they sold out. They flew off the shelves. People couldn't get them for their kids.
People went crazy for dinosaurs in general after this movie came out, too. I guess they already were a fan, but if they weren't, then they became one. I liked dinosaurs, but I wasn't as much as other people were. It was a big plot point in Friends, Ross, in that show. I think that show came out after this. He's a paleontologist. And at a few points in the series, he says it was his idea to do Jurassic Park. And this movie probably guaranteed the founding of DreamWorks SKG, which they started working on probably before this time frame, but Spielberg made Jurassic Park and Schindler's List in the same year. They came out only a few months apart, and then it was 4 years until his next movie, and I think the main reason was, okay, A, you take a break. He made movie after movie after movie for so long, but then he also was working on DreamWorks with Katzenberg and Geffen.
Yeah, he took one more giant step towards taking over the world. Do you remember what your impressions were of dinosaurs before Jurassic Park? There were artist renderings, the occasional animated, you know, you had The Land Before Time, or you had stop-motion attempts to render dinosaurs, but they were kind of more in the realm of imagination, or at least they have this kind of, like, phony sheen to them. I feel like there was a before Jurassic Park and an after Jurassic Park for how I thought about dinosaurs. They simply felt so much more real to me after this movie. Would you agree?
I think that's true for most people.
Kids who were born after Jurassic Park came out would have always known dinosaurs to have this real feeling, whereas for us, dinosaurs were this kind of phony imaginary thing until Jurassic Park made them real. There was a real incredible sea change in attitudes towards that, and that's probably why people became very interested in them. They became very popular. Also, one other influence thing, because we're Torontonians, it was not very long after this movie came out that we got our very first NBA franchise. I can't remember if there was a contest to name the team, or they definitely were open about the fact that there were different name options that they were considering, and they went with the Toronto Raptors, and it was really an almost embarrassingly obvious choice that was made because of Jurassic Park, because of the popularity of Jurassic Park.
And let's tie something together again. Sam Jackson in Jackie Brown. At the end of the movie, he comes into the bail bondsman and says, about the money, it's in my raptor bag. And the reason why he had a raptor bag is because he was shooting The Long Kiss Goodnight the year before Jackie Brown, and he was in Toronto shooting that, the home of the Raptors. He's a big basketball fan, so he was going to Raptors games.
No kidding!
Sam Jackson, how about that? Who is, we think, at least killed by a raptor in this movie. Okay, Jurassic Park won only 3 Oscars and was only nominated for 3. In fact, Spielberg films won 10 Oscars that night. We talked about that on The Piano, where Jane Campion's Spielberg movies between them won 13 Oscars in total and 10 for the Spielberg film. So it won for visual effects, obviously, for sound, obviously, and sound effects, very obviously. It was 35th on the Top 100 Thrills. I'm a little surprised it wasn't even higher. Psycho was number 1, of course, and it was nominated for the Top 100 Genres in the Sci-Fi category. And I already mentioned the quote, which they got wrong. It's not life will find a way, it's life finds a way. All right, well, the last thoughts on one of the more popular pictures out there, whether or not you love it. And by the way, I didn't really say, I like this movie an awful lot, but I wouldn't put it, I guess I did say this part, didn't I? I wouldn't put it in his top 10 if we're talking about every movie he's ever made.
I have been surprised to discover just how high esteem people hold this film in, especially when you compare it to his other great crowd-pleasing action films like Raiders, like E.T., like Jaws. I can't say I don't get it at all, but I'm surprised how forgiving people are of Jurassic Park's shortcomings when you consider how many better Spielberg movies there are to choose from that don't have such shallow characters, that don't indulge in so much silliness or so much sidetracking on B-plots that don't pay off, that just end up being loose ends. But once again, I cannot praise highly enough the action sequences of this film. The last hour is just straight fun from beginning to end and absolutely worth putting up with any of the things you may not like about it.
Well, I enjoy the movie. I've watched it lots of times, but I don't love it. I just like it quite a bit, certainly more than you. All right, I guess I talked about this during the podcast, but I'll promote it again. If you haven't listened to the debut episode of Scoring at the Movies with me and our friend Chris, go get that sucker. It's been available for download since late last week, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, you need to be a subscriber, and then it'll just download automatically. So, when the next 110 project kicks back into gear in 7 days, we'll slick back our hair and get deep into some difficult sexual politics with John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John singing and dancing in Greece. Greece is the word, is the word. This is more up your alley, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the coming attractions trivia for Greece. John Travolta is a noted Scientologist. Of the best-known Scientologists, and I'm including one that I think is one, who has the most movies that have grossed more than 100 million buckaroos at the domestic box office when adjusted for inflation? Tom Cruise, Will Smith, yes, he's one of them. He's a Scientologist.
Rumored.
Or John Travolta. Who's got the most $100 million movies adjusted for inflation?
So for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about Greece. And if you crave more Ryan and Bev between now and then, you can check out our website, top100project.com. As Ryan said, don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, you can check out our entire roster. We have over 250 movies now. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. Perhaps in return, you could give us a rating and a review. We really appreciate that. We are both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code top100project at checkout. That's all one word, top100project.
That is one big pile of shit.
And cut.